From the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Roballo. On today's show, Pennsylvania's budget deadlock is nearing 3 months, leaving schools, counties, and local services scrambling. Pike County is now taking a stand. Commissioner Matthew Osterberg joins us live to explain why timely budgeting isn't just a state issue, it's a local one that affects every resident. The Keeper is John Bauermaster's new documentary starring the Hudson River. The world premiere is coming up at the Woodstock Film Festival. We'll talk to him and learn more about the river's beauty and its hidden challenges. And a new show is joining Radio Catskill's schedule with good reason, bringing together exciting discoveries, rigorous debates, and new knowledge. And we'll meet the ever-curious host, Sarah McConnell, plus local economic perspective with James B. Huntington. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are preparing to hold talks at the White House this morning. The two leaders are set to discuss a new U.S. proposal to end the war in Gaza. NPR's Daniel Estrin describes some of the main points of the potential agreement.
It calls on Hamas to release all 48 of its remaining hostages, living and dead, up front. And then it calls for a gradual process where a multinational Arab and Muslim peacekeeping force would enter Gaza and Israeli forces would withdraw. Now, this is a plan that Trump presented to leaders of Arab countries in New York last week. It is the most serious effort yet since Trump entered office to end the war and to chart a post-war future for Gaza.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting from Tel Aviv. President Trump told Axios on Sunday that negotiations on a possible peace deal are at their final stages. Missouri has joined Texas in redrawing its congressional maps to give Republicans a better chance in next year's midterm elections. St. Louis Public Radio's Rachel Lippman reports the state's Republican governor signed the bill on Sunday.
The new map breaks up the Kansas City area district of Democrat Emanuel Cleaver into three. That could give the GOP a chance to win 7 of Missouri's 8 seats, up from the 6 it currently holds. The bill signing was closed to the media. The map already faces multiple legal challenges, and there is a possibility it never takes effect. Opponents are already gathering signatures to force a statewide vote. If they are successful, voters would have to approve the new districts. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Lippman in St. Louis.
Stocks on Wall Street opened mixed this morning amid news that a big video game maker is going private. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 15 points in early trading.
A trio of private equity firms is buying the video game giant Electronic Arts in a deal valued at $55 billion. EA is the company behind popular games like Madden NFL and The Sims. The buyers include Saudi Arabia's public investment fund and Jared Kushner's investment company. Lufthansa says it's adding more than 230 jets to its fleet by the end of the decade to keep up with strong demand for air travel, but the airline also says it plans to cut about 4,000 administrative workers, thanks to efficiency gains tied to artificial intelligence. And 58 million pounds of corn dogs and sausage on a stick are being recalled after complaints the stick was not the only wood piece in the batter. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The United States and South Korea are set to hold talks this week about securing visas for skilled Korean workers in the U.S. The meeting comes after more than 300 Koreans were taken into custody at a battery factory in Georgia this month. This is NPR News in Washington. The man charged in the death of conservative activist Charlie Kirk is set to make another court appearance today. A judge will determine whether there's enough evidence against 22-year-old Tyler Robinson to move ahead with a trial. Prosecutors have charged Robinson with aggravated murder and plan to seek the death penalty under state law in Utah. Puerto Rican superstar Bad Bunny will headline the Super Bowl halftime show in February. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento reports the announcement follows the singer's historic residency on the island.
Bad Bunny's latest album, Debí Tirar Más Fotos, is a love letter to Puerto Rican culture and history. And it's about to take on its biggest stage yet. In a press release, the NFL, Apple Music, and Roc Nation commended the 3-time Grammy winner for elevating Latin music to completely new heights, He has released some of the biggest songs and albums of the past decade, breaking streaming and touring records left and right. The 31-year-old is known for his outspoken political activism. Earlier this summer, he said he did not include the mainland U.S. in his upcoming world tour out of fear that Immigration and Customs Enforcement could target his concerts. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
Stocks are trading mixed on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow was down 59 points, the Nasdaq Composite up 177, the S&P 500 also trading higher, up 23 points. I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include 20th Century Studios, with Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, a pivotal chapter in the life of an icon, starring Jeremy Allen White and Jeremy Strong, in theaters October 24th. Tickets available now.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill, Great Chatskill, excuse me. This is, I'm Patricio Rubio sitting in for Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. As Pennsylvania's state budget impasse nears its third month, local governments and schools are feeling the strain. Pike County even issued a resolution urging state leaders to prioritize their responsibilities and finalize the 2026 budget without further delay. Joining us today is Pike County Commissioner Matthew Osterberg to discuss the county's urgent call for Pennsylvania state leaders to finalize the 2026 budget. Commissioner Osterberg, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here and talk to you about this impasse that's going on in Harrisburg that frustrates many of us in county government.
No, definitely, definitely. So, Commissioner, the Pike County Commissioners recently passed a resolution urging the governor and the legislature to, you know, finalize the state budget without any further delay. Can you explain why this has become such an issue for Pike County?
Well, you know, there's many services that county governments in Pennsylvania provide that are essential to the safety and well-being of our residents. You know, while people in Washington and Harrisburg think that they have, you know, that they affect the lives directly of the residents, it's really not true. It's really county government that does this because we're dictated and mandated to provide services that, that deal with people's health and well-being. You know, this can be in, you know, county government and all elected officials is about public safety. You know, and when they start to play around with the budget, when they start to not pass a budget and then hold back the funding that we need, it becomes very concerning, particularly to the most vulnerable in our community. You know, the things that we need to service and the things that, again, we're mandated by law. We don't have a choice but to run these services and we do it openly. I mean, that's why we took this job. We know. But, you know, you get into things like mental health and disability services and behavioral health and early childhood programs and drug and alcohol programs. You can just by the names of those, you can understand what part of the population is being harmed when if, and I say if at this moment, we have to start to stop programming or not pay the vendors or restrict the usage of it. It's those people that are sitting on the edges and on the verge of, you know, maybe some type of mental health issue. So, you know, it's those things that it just frustrates us. We understand that they need to, you know, use our money most effectively and spend it prudently. But at the same time, they need to figure this out well ahead of time, not just before they're getting ready to pass a budget. You know, the other things we deal with, children and youth services, you know, and family struggles. And, you know, again, just by the name of that, people in the community know that children and youth services are a much needed service because people's lives get, you know, they get taken down different paths for different reasons. And we as a society are there to make sure that we can help them and make sure everybody's safe, particularly in those cases of children. You know, then there's food pantries. There's a whole issue going on. Food pantries, you know, need to be funded. Again, just think about what that does in a community if you started to close down food pantries or restrict the amount of food that you would have there for those in need. The daycare situation that's going on here, I've spoken already to a number of daycare facilities that that are not being funded right now. They haven't been funded for 3 months. Well, August, September, yeah. July, August, and September now, that has a big effect on them. And, you know, What are they going to do if they close? What effect would that have on families again? If all of a sudden the daycare called the parents and said, we can't take them, we have to close. Well, that affects somebody's job now, because obviously the men and women, the mothers and fathers would have to not go to work. They need to figure this out in Harrisburg. And, you know, unfortunately, we seem to be maybe on a verge in Washington now. They need to, we in county government, by law, mandated again, no choice, must balance our budget. Well, you know what? It's time that they start to realize they have to balance their budget. I know, you know, there's different reasons as to why one side doesn't agree with the other. But again, they need to look at the victims and the people that could potentially be harmed by this delay. You know, our aging office, when we get to taking care of senior citizens and Meals on Wheels, you know, it's all of those things that, again, we in county government have no choice but to run those programs. But how do we do it if we all of a sudden don't have any funding? You know, and when it comes to funding in the county government, you know, people will say, well, go borrow some money. The problem in Pike County, in Pennsylvania government, county government, is if we borrow funds to help the shortfall right now, we need to pay those funds back by December 31st. We can't carry over lines of credit in county government from one year to the next. So there's a restriction. There is some help out there that recently was announced by our state treasurer, Stacey Garrity, who has made $500 million available for low interest loans at 4.5% for certain agencies, which would mean like places like daycares could go for that. Some of our mental health disability service agencies could go for those loans. Again, but they're going to be paying 4.5% interest on money that's due them, you know. And that's another thing that sits in people's craw is, you know, you're going to lend me money that you owe me, and then you're going to charge me 4.5% interest to use it. It's bizarre, but it's unfortunate that we're in this position in Pennsylvania. And as I said, it seems like maybe unless they fix it today and tomorrow, we're going to be on the same horizon here with Washington.
Yeah, I mean, I can hear your frustration there. Have you reached out to anyone in Harrisburg and the, you know, the state lawmakers? Has there been any response?
Well, we have. And, you know, you saw our resolution. Our resolution mm-hmm. was also put out there by, I believe, every county in the state. All 67 put the resolution out because it came from the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. We have reached out to our senators and our reps. And, you know, there's different resolutions on the table there that would extend last year's budget into this year so that they would just have continue with the same spending that they had for 2020 for the previous year. But that stalls because, you know, one side doesn't want this in there, and they're trying to just hold their, you know, hold people's feet to the fire. And they, believe me, our representatives are very responsive to us, but it's, you know, they could vote either way, but, you know, that's only – there's 100 senators, or there's 50 senators and a number of state reps. It just gets very frustrating of how this all goes, you know. And that's what you hear us say in our resolution, you know. And basically the other thing you hear from people is, you know, you shouldn't be going home. You should all be in Harrisburg working on this to make sure that this gets settled. We hope it's sooner than later because, again, we don't know what we will do. And I don't want to speculate on anything right now because I don't want to put fear in anybody's mind. Right now, we in the county seem to be functioning okay. Our disability services seem to be functioning. They're identifying ways for them to borrow money. They fall under a different parameter of rules so that they can borrow money moving into the next calendar year, as opposed to us being, you know, directly county government cannot do that. So that's what we just need to work at. We need to be creative in county government of how we address this.
Yeah. Now, looking back at Pike County's history, has a budget, you know, come down to the wire like this before?
You know, I believe a number of years ago there was an issue like this. In other times, you know, some of that stuff you forget about, you know, because it's a little painful then. And, you know, I know there's been budget impasses in Pennsylvania before, and some of them have lasted this long, maybe even a little longer. I can't recall them. You know, I I live in the moment, not worrying about what happened in the past. So right now we need to deal with this one.
Right. Now, you know, you mentioned about the potentially of borrowing money, you know, continue these operation. In the past, I want to look at past a little bit here, but has Pike County have done this before in a similar situation?
You mean borrow money?
Yeah, borrow money to sort of meet the shortfall.
As I say to you, every year in county government, because of the way the taxes come in, we do what they call as a tax anticipation note. But that has nothing to do with a budget impasse. That has to do with cash flow. Because in Pennsylvania, our real estate taxes don't start to come in until like March or April. But we have to keep a business going from January through there. So we take out what they call a tax anticipation note. But that tax anticipation note must be paid back 100% by December 31st of that year. So the same thing is true here. We could borrow money right now, but I'm going to borrow money against what? And what money am I going to use to pay it off of in December 31st if I don't have the funds? You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's just a state law. Again, it's a mandate from Harrisburg that tells us we can't do this stuff, right? And this is what's very annoying about this. And believe me, somebody has to deal with these programs that I mentioned earlier in this interview. But at the same time, you know, when you're mandated to do it, then they should be mandated to make sure they continue to fund us continually, not delay this. Because, the people that are going to be harmed are the ones that are in most need and the most vulnerable in our community. And that's really a shame that we hold those people as somewhat as victims in this whole thing. And, you know, and it's just very frustrating. It is. And they hear our frustration.
Now, have these organization and like you mentioned, like the daycares, have you heard from them whether they're planning, a plan B if this impasse continues to fund their own organizations?
Yeah, I have spoken to them, and I just spoke to them over the weekend again, particularly about this grant possibility or loan possibility with the state. Because the difference with that loan with Stacey Garrity and the Treasurer's Department is they would not have to pay it back until the state impasse was over and money started to flow again, and that's when they would pay the interest. So it's a little different in the fact that, you know, with a bank, if they go and take out a bank, there's going to be payments due fairly rapidly, right? But again, back to the whole thing is, okay, so I got a loan, but I can't pay the loan back because I'm using the loan money to keep my operation afloat. So I'm waiting today for a phone call from the state senator's office to identify how I can direct these daycares to be able to apply for those funds so that we can keep them open and operating. So that's where we are right now. So
yeah, I mean, you're talking about the daycares. We had not the same situation, but last year we had some funding situations with the Head Start, and they had to close down for a couple of weeks. I just remember the stories I was seeing on social media about parents sort of scrambling to find some kind of child care for them, for their child, and dealing with, like you said, parents have jobs, have to go to, and some jobs are not always forgiving in these situations. So.
Yeah, and well, you know, it's not even the jobs are forgiving, but some jobs, whoever the employer is, whatever the profession is, you know, they need the personnel to be there. Mm. They can't, you know,
right.
You know, if you take, you know, go to some place that works, somebody that works in a hospital or those type of urgent needs, right? The hospital can't function if they're going to have a number of people saying, I can't come in today because I have nobody to watch my child. But what talk about putting parents in a really difficult position, right? You got a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old child, and you have to go to work so you can make sure you can put food on the table. What kind of choices are there? You know, I don't terrible choices.
No, definitely. Pike County does. I'm assuming it's not alone in this. You know, has Pike County collaborated with other counties or organizations sort of advocate for a timely state budget action?
Yeah, well, that's what the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania is. That's a statewide organization that I believe all counties belong to it. We belong to it. And that's where our voice is heard in Harrisburg as a group. You know, 67 counties, in many cases, each county has 3 commissioners. Some have a little bit more. So it's a large organization with a large voice and a good relationship with our state senators and our House representatives are very good, you know. And that's where the proclamation or the resolution that we read at the last meeting came from, so it shows Harrisburg, all the county commissioners are on the same page. We're all facing the same issues when it comes to these services, whether it's here in Pike County or it's in Philadelphia or it's in, you know, Dauphin County, which is Harrisburg, you know, the larger counties, you know, we're on the smaller side. But everybody has the same issues going on, regardless of the size of their county.
Yeah.
It's still affecting the residents in their community that need the most help.
Mm. Well, Commissioner, before we go, you know, is there anything you would like Pike County residents to know about, you know, the efforts and and why this issue? You mentioned a lot before already, but why this issue matters to every resident in the state?
Well, as I say, you know, when you think about the general public, you know, many of us live, you know, very good lives and, you know, don't have to face the issues that some families have to when you look at what these services are that we must provide. Those are our friends and neighbors who have fallen maybe on hard times or something has impacted their life. And if we're going to do anything in this community, we're going to stand up for each other and make sure that we can help them along. And that's what these services do. So, you know, here in Pike County, what we're doing continually is we're talking to them in Harrisburg and we're urging them, and they know it. We got to get this done. It needs to get done sooner than later. Figure this out or just pass an impasse bill. A bill that would just allow things to be funded and then figure out the next budget as you move along. But let the money start to flow. The money is there. It's not like the money dried up. Just let the money start to flow because it's going to start to hurt people.
Yeah.
Well, that's the last thing we don't want to see happen, right? We want to see some type of delay in services cause somebody irreparable harm. And I'll just leave it at that, you know, and then we'll all feel really bad about it. And, you know, we in county can jump up and down and yell at them for allow it to occur. But who wants to do that? We don't want to do that. We don't want to see people harmed at all.
No, not at all. Well, Commissioner, thank you so much for joining us. I do really appreciate it. And good luck with the fight of getting this budget handed in time.
You're welcome. Have a great day. Fall is here.
Yes, definitely. We'll take a break, and when we come back, John Bauermaster's documentary, The Keeper, puts Hudson River center stage, showing its story, its beauty, its challenges, and we'll learn more next. This is Radio Chatskill.
In Irene Soloway's garden in Wayne County, Pennsylvania, there's bright orange marigolds, sunflowers, and towards the back, lots and lots of peppers.
This is Pepper Joe, which is a sweet pepper. It's actually, we had it in our frittata this morning. I don't know if you noticed it.
I'm David Lombardo, host of the Capital Press Room, a daily public radio program with the latest insight and analysis from Albany. Listen for stories from the halls of the state capitol, interviews with policymakers, and an in-depth look at the state government decisions affecting your life. Tune into the Capitol Press Room weekdays at 1, starting October 6th, as part of the local, state, and national coverage here on Radio Catskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back. This is Radio Chatskill. From sweet and mild to spicy and hot, the first annual Pepperfest kicks off in Damascus, Pennsylvania, this Saturday, October 4th. It's a new festival celebrating, guess what, the love of peppers in the Upper Delaware River Valley. The award-winning Radio Catskill Kimberly Izar headed down to Tyler Hill, Pennsylvania to talk to the Pepperfest Planning Committee to learn what folks can expect and brings us this report.
In Irene Soloway's garden in Wayne County, Pennsylvania, there's bright orange marigolds, sunflowers, and towards the back, Lots and lots of peppers.
This is Pepper Joe, which is a sweet pepper. It's actually, we had it in our frittata this morning. I don't know if you noticed it. It's very, very sweet. It's like candy sweet. And so that's going to be for the zero level, mm-hmm. for the you
oh,
know.
Okay. Oh, this one's for the, zero.
Yeah, you don't have to be brave to do
yeah,
a to
me.
Do it. We encourage people to, even if they start with one, zero, you know, and maybe go to zero to one.
She and a few of her neighbors are organizing the first annual Pepper Fest on Saturday, October 4th. Irene Soloway and Anna B. Ott are two of the event organizers and pepper growers themselves. When they first started growing peppers, they said they had no idea what they were getting into when they started their journey. But that's the fun of it. We sat around the kitchen table with coffee and breakfast, along with other members of the planning committee. Here is some of that conversation.
I'm Irene Soloway. I've been in Tyler Hill since 1991, and we started a garden, had no idea that it would be a mostly digging of rocks and fending off animals, and discovered that peppers were actually easy to grow up here, and the little rodents and groundhogs and weren't interested. So peppers became our main crop.
I'm Anna. I'm actually a painter, but I've been growing peppers since COVID, actually. That's what all started 2020 on my balcony in Bucks County. And since then, I've been experimenting with, at one point, I had like 20 different varieties, and they're doing very well because I had lots of sun. But once we moved here 2 years ago, I'm trying to grow peppers here. I find it a little bit challenging because our property has a lot of shade in it, but I'm adjusting my practice, so hopefully next year we'll have better results anyway. But peppers are fun, and it brings people together, and we just love it.
I was really excited to interview you both because peppers for me are exactly what you said. Like, they're so fun because it's kind of like a surprise, right? Like, it could be very mild or it could be very spicy. And then it's also like it's like a staple ingredient, right, that is used around the world.
Yeah.
I'm curious, you know, you both talked about how you got into your pepper gardening journey. Tell me a little bit about what it's like growing from seed to harvest, kind of what that process is like.
To me, when I originally started, I went just to Home Depot and got like different seeds. And then we have a friend who's been teaching hot peppers at the Chicago Botanical Gardens for years. And he's like, what are you growing? Like, how can you can buy it in a store? I'm like, I don't know any other peppers. So he sent us some like very interesting peppers like chili de aqua, the breast, and like really also not super hot, the sheep nose. Is there a sheep nose?
Oh, the sheep nose. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a cool pepper. So I tried that. And next year I discovered those websites where you can buy seeds like Pepper Joe and chili hot pepper. So I ordered and like, over-ordered 20 different.
Like, amazing.
And also some, like when you order, they give you actually Schohill. And I'm looking at the peppers. They look amazing. Colors, shapes, like insane.
Well, we actually started out with actually small plants. We went to a place called chiliplants.com in New Jersey, where pretty much the sun seems to shine a lot more, and got very small plants and nurtured them. That's how we started out because it's such a short season here. But as we started growing them, there were certain peppers that we really loved. And so then if they really did well, then we started saving the seed. And then now we're actually starting more from seed. And there is a particular pepper that we're really, really proud of that actually came over, the seeds of which came over from Bhutan in the pocket of a Bhutanese Buddhist Lama, and was given to us to grow for him. Because he couldn't stay in the area for too long without this particular Bhutan pepper. And we grew that pepper from seed, and it turned into this amazing, wonderful pepper that we felt like we nurtured, you know. And we couldn't find it anywhere in Chile, chiliplants.com didn't have it. None of the other seed companies had it. So growing from seed is something very special because you can actually, with our terroir, our land, and our climate, we see what does well, and then we keep that going.
Listening to you describe this growing of the Bhutanese pepper, it makes me also think about how gardening is an act of like preservation as well, which I think is really beautiful. Around this time, I started thinking, well, let's check out some peppers.
And so it's kind of starting here, it's the sweeter ones, and going down to the more powerful ones. Most peppers start out green. And some of them go like green, green, purple, yellow, red,
orange. Yeah. And actually, they change their taste and heat level with the when they change the color. Oh. We had our favorite pepper is Aji Gold Limon, and when it's green, it's so like it almost tastes like soap. It's very strange taste. But when it's get like bright yellow, then it's so perfumey. It's like very fruity, but also it's really good heat. But then it's also very like really amazing. No, it's kind of sweet, but it's very hard to describe the taste. It's kind of sweet and it's very aromatic. It's very pleasant.
This one is Sarit Ga, which is it's actually from Kosovo.
Oh, wow.
It's a cayenne type, and it's described as having citrus, fruity flavor tones and an upfront burn. So some peppers have the back burn, right, and some has the front burn, and some have the middle burn. So this, right, it's just really,
it's really. Oh, it's fascinating.
So it's like, does the burn overwhelm the other notes? And that's the kind of thing we're going to be exploring.
From fiery red tones to soft yellow bell-shaped peppers, the crew is preparing a variety of peppers from around the world for the inaugural Pepper Fest. One pepper had a name to match its fire.
This is Naga Viper. And you can tell by the name, right?
Yeah.
That it's going to bite you in on the tongue.
Spicy.
Yeah, look at that. And you look like you're ready for that.
Oh, no. I'm a mild pepper baby.
So we're going to have a good selection. And I love it because it's so wrinkled. Yeah. And it's like almost evil.
It does.
Yeah. And that was actually created in the UK, the Naga Viper.
This should be spicy too. It's new, but
this was a three-way cross between a Buchalakia, which is a ghost pepper, Trinidad scorpion, and a Naga Morich. So this was created by an English person. So peppers go, you know, they travel.
They're all around the world.
Yeah, they travel. And let's see.
Mm-hmm. And which ones are these?
This is, it's called Jaloro. It's actually a jalapeno, but it was hybridized in Texas with the Agricultural Extension in 1992. And it's actually, instead of most jalapenos are green, this one is yellow, and it's has thicker skin, and it's actually fruitier.
Wow.
So, and it seems to be very productive here. And like when we were talking about growing peppers in this particular region, we find out because there's so much variety of peppers. I mean, international. There's
you can see just in this bag.
Yeah.
So many different types.
So we learn like, well, this one seems to be doing really well in this area. So this one is a real keeper.
Pepperfest is expected to be packed with flavor. There will be a potluck with different dishes peppered with peppers and a guided pepper tasting, from sweet and mild to hot and spicy. Irene and Anna say they've designed the tasting to be accessible for everyone.
And we're not, this is not a macho contest.
No.
It's not about how, you know, how hot can you go and how much can you suffer. It's really just it's an exploration.
Yeah.
And we want people to actually take the time to really experience each one.
Absolutely. And learn that it's not just peppers and not only about the heat. There's so much more about the hot peppers than just heat.
Pepperfest will be a donation-based event, with all proceeds going to the Volunteer Ambulance, Fire Department, and Damascus Manor Community Center. The festival will be on October 4th from 12 to 4 p.m. at the Damascus Township Park Pavilion, rain or shine. In Tyler Hill, Pennsylvania, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Kimberly, for that spicy report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, John Bauermaster's documentary, The Keeper, puts the Hudson River center stage, showing its story, its beauty, and its challenges. We'll learn more next. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Janice Adams. Starting Monday, October 6th, join me on my new day and new time, Monday evenings at 8, for the Janice Adams Show. Crucial conversations about race, every race, and courage. The courage to listen, to speak up, to make a way out of no way. The Janice Adams Show, Monday nights at 8, starting October 6th on Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, whenever air traffic controllers are making headlines, that is probably not a good thing.
The system will not last forever. Every day that goes by, we're getting one day closer to when the thing will break.
So what would it take to fix air traffic control?
It's so obvious what the answer here is.
We will look into it next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Patricio Roballo. Joining us today is filmmaker John Bauermaster, whose environmental documentary, The Keeper, is having its world premiere at the Woodstock Film Festival next month. The film stars New York's Hudson River as his main character and follows the patrol boat captain John Lipscomb, the longtime eyes and ears of the riverkeeper, as reports on environmental issues, both natural and man-made. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, welcome, and I'm happy to follow Pepperfest. I love peppers.
Don't we all? So I want to know, what inspired you to make The Keeper, and why did you choose the Hudson River as the film's main character?
Well, I've lived in the Hudson Valley for 38 years or so, and we've made 20 short films, short ranging from 5 minutes to 40 minutes, about varying issues on the Hudson, both. We started making a series called The Hudson River at Risk, looking at environmental concerns, and we morphed into making more positive, optimistic stories under the banner of Hope on the Hudson. And this feature film, which has its premiere at the Woodstock Film Festival, is kind of a culmination of all those years of reporting. You know, I wanted to tell a story about the Hudson River today, but I didn't want to do it in a kind of that too technical way, so we followed for 4 years. We followed John Lipscomb, who drove the Hudson Riverkeeper boat up and down the river for the past 25 years, and he became our kind of thread or our guide to the river and its issues and its concerns.
Yeah, well, how did you connect with John, the other John, John Lipscomb?
The other John?
Yeah. And not only how did you connect with him, but what was it like following him as he reported, you know, on the river's environmental challenges?
Well, I mean, he's a great advocate for the river, and he's a great raconteur, storyteller, et cetera. But yeah, no one really likes to be followed by cameras, or very few really. So he balked a little bit when we would show up and just go on the boat. We didn't really create anything for him to do. We just followed him along. But that meant, you know, riding two or three or four of us riding on the boat with him, which became, you know, occasionally challenging. But he certainly understands. His father was a filmmaker, so he understands the power of media in terms of trying to draw attention to environmental concerns and our environmental future. He gets the fact that media makes a difference.
Yeah, no, definitely. So, you know, the film shows both natural and human cause issues affecting the Hudson River. Were there any particular, like, discoveries that sort of surprised you during filmmaking?
Well, you know, the Hudson River has a long history of contamination going back to the 1940s when General Electric dumped millions of gallons of PCBs, chemicals, into the Hudson River. So that's kind of always lurking in the background. You know, the main question people have is, how is the river? And oftentimes what they're looking for is whether there's any kind of concern about contamination or bacterial mess or something. But over the years, in part thanks to guys like John Lipscomb, the river has gotten cleaner. And as a result, the concerns have changed a little bit. It used to be when John started driving the Riverkeeper boat up and down the river 25 years ago, you know, his main concern were looking for like industrial pollution, people with kind of dumping illegally or, you know, not having proper sewage pipes, et cetera. And increasingly now it's really about a big focus of keeping or cleaning up the Hudson is working with municipalities to limit the amount of wastewater that goes into the river. So when John travels, when he takes people out on the Riverkeeper boat, he holds up people say, how's the river? And who are the big polluters? He holds up a mirror and puts it in their face because we have a sizable issue in New York, like, to be honest, the rest of the country, the rest of the world, of what do we do with wastewater once it's quote unquote filtered.
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, I mean, that's one thing that sort of surprised. I'm originally from the city, and when I moved up here to the Catskills, you know, I really, as a reporter, I sort of, you know, discovered that a lot of the wastewater basically goes back into the streams and creeks that are here locally. And that's something that sort of surprised me. But obviously, you know, we hope and that the wastewater treatment plants does its job and releases clean water. But I want to talk, sort of pull back a little bit here. How does the Hudson River reflect the broader issues, the broader environment issues that are facing the United States now?
Well, you know, there are you can't ignore the environmental issues that exist. Climate change is creating sea level rise, which is a concern on the Hudson. You know, we all remember those pictures of storm surges in New York City. You know, where water was flooding down into the subways, et cetera. Occasionally, more and more frequently, our trains don't run on time because there's water kind of on the tracks. I mean, all due to sea level rise. So that's a concern. You know, the population of the Hudson Valley is growing. So as a result, there's more demand for building and for clean water. You know, how many? I could put it as a trivia question for you, but how many people in the Hudson River get their drinking water from the river? It's just over 100,000 people, residents, get their drinking water from the Hudson. So it's imperative that we do a good job to keep it clean. But in the long list of environmental concerns, you know, where does rebuilding wastewater sewage plants come? It's kind of far, sadly, kind of far down the list. You've got, you know, the Hudson River joins the estuary, which leads out to the Atlantic Ocean, which means that the Hudson River at one point combines with salt. So there's salt water in there, and that salt is reaching further and further north, which is threatening slowly the technology that cleans the river. So it's there are a handful of climate related issues that are impacting. They're not far away. They're not in the somewhere halfway around the world, right here in our backyard. So, that said, the river is definitely cleaner than it was, you know, we'll say 40, 50 years ago, without question.
Well, let's talk about, you know, who or what would you say are the river's main enemies today, and what can be done to sort of address, you know, these challenges?
Yeah, well, we've talked about briefly the two major problems. One is that PCB contamination remains in the river. We work with, and he's prominent in the film, a Dr. David Carpenter at the University of Albany, who has kind of been leading the charge for the last, you know, 40 years on just how PCBs, once dumped into the river, they don't just impact the river, they impact the air, the water, the and human health around. So PCBs remain, and cleaning PCBs out of the river remain a sizable challenge. There are groups that have been working on getting PCBs out of the river for 40, 50 years. GE dumped from 1947 to 1977, so it's cleaning up 30 years of bad habits. So yeah, the PCB issue is one, and then the other that we touched on, the wastewater treatment. The problem is our sewage plants are old and overworked, and as a result, whenever it rains, you know, half an inch or more, the sewage plants combine with the wastewater, or, you know, running off of streets and things, to create this badly polluted water. Have you seen the river recently? You're in Catskill, right?
Yeah, I'm in the Catskills. So I'm in Catskills.
Yeah. Well, but you've seen pictures, or maybe you've seen in person, this kind of green algae, mm-hmm, bacteria that's been floating down the surface of the river the last week or so.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's just another, that's a result of a hotter atmosphere and a drier atmosphere. You know, we had almost no rain in August and very little in September. It's created this circumstance where the river can grow or allow this bacteria to blossom, basically. And it has human health effects potentially. So, if it's not one thing, it's another.
It sounds like it. You know, while you were filming this documentary, did anything give you hope about the river's future?
I'm sorry, give us hold?
No, while filming this documentary, was there anything that gave you hope about the river's future?
Oh, yeah, plenty of things. You know, the tricky thing about the Hudson River, it's muddy, but it's not dirty. You know, but if you put your hand in the Hudson, once your fingers are 5 inches down, you can't see them anymore because it's murky from the mud. So people have this impression it's a brown, dirty river, but that's not the case. It's actually very clean, and the wildlife is incredible. You know, in our film, The Keeper, it has beautiful images of underwater images of herring and shad and bass coming in from the ocean, and all sorts of bird life, and big sturgeon that live on the bottom of the river. I mean, we don't see it necessarily, but there's incredible wildlife. John Lipscomb, the hero of our film, describes it as the Serengeti of waterways, just filled with wildlife that returns and uses the river as a home.
Yeah. Well, let's take a look. Let's go back to you're premiering The Keeper at the Woodstock Film Festival. You are a local filmmaker. What does it mean for you to premiere the movie at Woodstock Film Festival?
It's fantastic. Yeah, I have a long experience writing books and making films. I've made more than 30 documentaries. And we did this series called the Hudson River Stories, which a lot of these shorter films are on among them. And we've shown other short films at the Woodstock Film Festival, which is, I think in this case, this year it's the 15th to the 19th of October. But to have this project that we worked on for 4+ years, have its literally its first screening at the Woodstock Film Festival is great. You know, I've made films on every continent and I worked a lot with National Geographic.
Wow.
But at a certain point, you realize you don't have to travel halfway around the world to find good stories. You don't have to travel halfway around the world to find powerful environmental stories. They're right here in our backyard. And that's what this is. So it for me, the Keeper is really this really beautiful, up-to-date film about the health of the Hudson River, and guided by this very charismatic, cantankerous keeper who looks after the river, as you said in your introduction, is the eyes and ears of the river.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations that The Keeper is going to be in the Woodstock Film Festival.
Yeah, please come. It's the premiere. The first screening is on October 18th. It's a Saturday, 4 p.m. in the heart of Woodstock.
That's great. So you can find more information at woodstockfilmfestival.org. Again, thank you so much, John. I do really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
All right. We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from our very own James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we hear the exotic sounds of Arthur Lyman and Les Baxter. Plus, there's something new by the Midday Mai Tais Project. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Why not join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred? The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
Princeton University President Chris Eisgruber says higher education is being tested.
We have to be steadfast in our commitments to free speech, academic freedom, civility. You can't succeed as a university if you start giving up on those principles.
We'll talk with Eisgruber about free speech, anti-Semitism, academic freedom, and the historic numbers of Americans who say college isn't even worth it anymore. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders, reminding you to join me and my friends for Laura Flanders and Friends on Radio Catskill Monday evenings at 7, followed by Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk. And then, starting October 6th, we welcome the Janice Adams Show to its new night at 8, followed by La Voz en Breve with Mariel Fiore. Four powerhouse shows back-to-back, local voices bringing world-class conversations about what's really happening in our lives. Monday evenings on Radio Catskill.
The course of true love never did run smooth. Shakespeare wrote those words hundreds of years ago, and they still ring true today. I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of Hidden Brain. Join me for Love 2.0, a new series featuring ideas that will make your relationship the stuff of great literature or just help it to run a little more smoothly. That's Love 2.0 all through the month of October. Today at 1 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatsko. I'm Patricio Robayo. It's Monday, and it's time to talk about the economy. Our very own economist, James B. Hunton, is on the phone with us now to give us our local economic perspective. Hello, James B.
Good morning, Patricio. Good morning, listeners.
Yes, yes. The one and only James B. Hunton. So let's talk about what happened with the Federal Reserve's favored inflation measure last week.
Yes, well, it went up in some measures. It's up 0.3% from August from a month ago, and up 2.7% from last year. That's the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. The core PCA, which leaves out food and energy prices, was up 0.2% from the previous month and 2.9% year over year. These were all about what was expected. No real surprises here. So inflation is staying a little higher than some people would like, but it's still nowhere near a lot of historic levels, which have been much higher than 3 or 4% even. So it's not terrible, but it's nothing really newsy about what we found out here last week.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question about this, James. Do you think we ever will see, mortgage rate to go back down to 3%? Or is that, not in our future anymore?
Very easily could. Then what we would need is not only the Federal Reserve's interest rates being set a lot lower, but conditions that would justify that. Mainly, we'd need low unemployment and low inflation. When we get those things, we would have a real reason to reduce interest rates. But especially if inflation, if unemployment creeps up more and more, interest rates may go down in an effort to bring that lower. So it's going to depend on the market and interest rates, but it's very possible that we could have cheap mortgages once again.
Mm. Well, let's take a look at what's happening with the American economy. How much did it grow in the second quarter?
Well, it went up 3.8%, which was a little better than people thought. Actually, it's a fine percentage for the economy could be growing. A lot of people are predicting that it's going to go down with the tariffs and all. It's going to be reduced in the second half of the year, but for now it's quite solid. So there is a lot of economic activity, and from this point of view, it's going well.
So, something that I was driving to work today, and I'm hearing an NPR about the government shutdown. I know is still in talks with the current administration. What effect might a government shutdown have on investments?
Usually there's not much. Usually it's a temporary thing. People get really more dramatic about this than it should be, because there are so many exceptions to the shutdowns. Like Medicare doesn't stop, Social Security doesn't stop. The same thing goes with air traffic control, postal and military service. and a lot of other things that are set aside. The remaining people are officially unpaid during the shutdown, but virtually always they are given the pay they made up sometime later in the year, or rather the pay they did not get. So there's a lot of concern. It's more of a symbolic thing than anything else. It would be awfully strange if they decided not to restart it or put in some changes or something, which could happen. The situation now is our current presidential administration may take that as an opportunity to lay people off more permanently. They've been trying to do that. They may be able to sneak that in. That could be fought out in Congress or even later on in the courts, but that would have a big effect. Otherwise, not much difference. I think once investors think that it's going to be ended in a normal way, once it started, that it's not going to have any real effect on any investment vehicles.
Okay. So let's take a look at what's happening with stock, oil, and precious metals and crypto prices this early morning. Did anything change, and how did they change?
Oh, yes. Over the last week, this is from early this morning, the prices I have here, gold, $38.19, went up $98. It's just going up, up, up. It's setting all-time highs more weeks than that, and this is another one. Silver, $46.90, up $3.20. That shrunk the ratio between gold and silver to 81.5 to 1, but that was a huge week for silver. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 46,247, up 94 points. It got the best of an up-and-down week, but not by much. I mean, probably 4 of the 5 days for trading this last week had ups or downs more than 94, but it almost evened out, ended up on the good side. NASDAQ, 22,484, down 2,040, a truly bad week, but really it did not even offset the jump last week, so it's still higher than it was 2 weeks ago. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $64.99 the barrel, up $1.95. It's looking like better business times, and looks like they're going to sell more of it. That's the main thing there. Bitcoin, 112,137, down 425. That's quite a modest loss. It could be getting ready for another jump up. It's been hanging around for a few weeks at something, 10,000 or so less than its all-time high. British pound, 1.3433, down 64 hundredths of a cent. And the euro, 1.1720, down 45 hundredths of a cent. Both of them just small, relatively small losses. They've been going up and down. They have situations in their countries as well as ours which affect that. And guess what? The Japanese 100 yen coin at 67 cents actually changed, believe it or not. For the first time in 2 or 3 months, it's lost a penny. So overall, we could be looking at some real changes coming up soon. We wonder how high these metals and the Dow, for that matter, how high can they get? They haven't had corrections. They haven't had any real fallbacks. They've been just getting higher and higher and higher. And it all feeds on itself, because the more money people make at some of these things, the more money they may have to put into the other things and drive up the prices there. So we'll see later this year, but don't be shocked if sometime these things do go down. It's been a tremendous year for all three of those things.
Yeah. Well, James, thank you so much for joining us. This is all the time we have for your perspective on the local economic outlook there. Thank you so much, James, for joining us. We'll talk to James B. Huntington next week, Monday. Thank you again, James.
Thank you, Patricio. Thank you, listeners.
And that does it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Roballo. Tim Bruno will be back tomorrow. Let's take a quick look at the weather. Today, partly sunny with a high near 77. And tonight, mostly cloudy with a low around 53. And Tuesday, partly sunny with a high near 77. This is Radio Chatskill. Thanks for listening.
I'm Jesse King. On this week's 51%, the Trump administration is promoting an unproven link between Tylenol and autism, urging pregnant women not to take the painkiller. We learn about what moms should know.
There's absolutely no credible study to suggest that taking acetaminophen during a pregnancy is in any way linked to autism.
This week on 51%.
Monday night at 8 on Radio Cat.